Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. Workers are flooding into Douglas as oil and gas production takes off. The small area is still figuring out how to handle it.
Their town could be left in the wake of this oil boom, shining like a star, instead of being crushed and jails filled, roads crumbling.
April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month, so how well does Wyoming handle this crime?
From what we hear from survivors, it's very hit or miss out there across the state.
Two Wyoming congressional leaders want to do away with the Affordable Care Act, but they say they're fighting a narrative.
The Democrats are going to continue to peddle this notion, this lie, that somehow Republicans don't want to cover people with pre-existing conditions.
We'll have those stories and much more on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. Converse County has become the new epicenter of oil and gas production in Wyoming. And with a gas plant under construction now, too, workers from all over the country are flooding the area. Today, we'll hear two stories from the small town of Douglas, population 6,300, on how the new arrivals are taking a toll on Douglas's limited housing and its most vulnerable residents. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim starts us off.
It's freezing outside as Terry Short smokes a cigarette under his hotel's awning near downtown Douglas. He's wearing a Dallas Cowboys sweatshirt, his hometown team.
For the most part, it's this nice little sleepy town that, you know, generally doesn't have a whole lot of chaos going on.
Short is an oil field worker for a company called Gunslinger. He's far from the only worker of his kind in the area. He says folks get a certain amount of money to live on by companies, and they search for a cheaper way to live, both to save and support families.
Sometimes if they know they're going to be in there long enough, they might get you a lease, or you might be responsible for getting your own living accommodations, so you might have to take it upon yourself to either RV, hotel, or do the apartment or long term.
The manager at this hotel says oil field workers started arriving in droves last October. George says the whole town has become chaotic.
But I've been here since September. It's been a lot busier than I anticipated for a town this size.
Facing Short is a parking lot confirming just that. It's full of GMC, Ram, and Ford pickups, each used for services from electricity to gravel. It's the same in downtown Douglas, with trucks filling up Pizza Hut, the Village Inn, and Safeway. Joel Schell says it's gotten bad. He's the Converse County Treasurer. He says address requests are up, RV parks and campgrounds are all full, and my personal favorite...
I go to Safeway, and I'm frustrated because, there's no apples. Like, how can you have a grocery store with no apples, right?
5 years ago, Converse County produced only 17% of the state's oil. But the rise of horizontal drilling and a promise for thousands of new wells has pushed that to a 33% share and rising. And so, Shell says oil-filled workers aren't just filling RV parks, but affordable hotels and rentals.
Most of them are staying in Casper because we're full. You know they wouldn't do that if they could stay here, if there was housing available here.
It's a 45-minute commute to Casper. For those who do stay in town, Shell explains workers often group together in a place, and that can cause prices to shoot up. He explains that's what happened during the last boom just a few years ago.
House rentals went from, right around $700 a month before the boom to $1,500 during the boom. And some of that, I think, was that per diem where you had workers combining to rent places.
The lack of housing now is causing a price spike, too, driven by low supply. Realtors say there's no rental availability in town, with new listings snagged before the day is out. From 2017 to 2018, the average cost of a rental went up nearly 10%, according to a report from the Wyoming Business Council. Shell says it's easy for year-round residents to get priced out.
And some people who, were still had nothing really to do with the industry, the energy industry, were still making the same incomes, got priced out of those apartments.
Everyone's just scrambling to find what they can in the area.
That's Dane Corville, a project manager for SAM Inc., which surveys for possible pipeline routes in Converse County. He's had crews around Douglas for a year and a half. Right now, low housing has them staying in hotels in Casper. Corville's aware the toll an oil boom can have on a town.
Yeah, I think about that all the time.
Like the pros, plenty of new customers for the local economy, and the cons.
There's a lot of riffraff, too, that comes in. They're a cross-section of society just like any other position.
But Corville says residents are not powerless to the boom, that companies rely on landowner participation, and they can ask for more than just a check. Corville says he's seen it happen.
You have no idea how much money is changing hands between a huge ranch and a pipeline company. I mean, we're talking millions of dollars. And for them to just turn over and say, hey, in addition to that $4.2 million check you're about to give me, I want you to also give that old folks home downtown a check for $100,000 too.
Or parks or even affordable housing. A Wyoming Business Council report found there's demand for another 200 units of that sort of housing. Corbel says it would be smart for landowners to keep the community at large in mind.
Their town could be left in the wake of this oil boom, shining like a star instead of being crushed and jails filled, roads crumbling. It can go either way.
As far as new housing, construction companies have little incentive to build, knowing the boom will end and people will leave. But for now, the rush to lease and develop new land in Converse County is just starting. There are about 1,400 wells and thousands more on their way. There's one group in particular that's vulnerable to Douglas' limited housing market, brought about by the perennial boom and bust cycle. I'm Cooper McKim, and I'm going to pass that part of the story on to my colleague, Melody Edwards.
Yeah, for many survivors of domestic violence, it's hard enough trying to escape a dangerous situation. But in a small town like Douglas with very high rent, it can feel virtually impossible. I knock on the door of an apartment in the one and only income-restricted apartment complex in Douglas.
Hi.
You're Elise?
Yes, I am.
I'm Melody.
Nice to meet you. Come on in.
Thank you.
29-year-old Elise shows me in and gives me a tour of the small apartment she shares with her two children.
And then up here...
We're not using her last name to protect her from retaliation.
Yeah,
a sign on the living room wall says, Home Sweet Home. And for Elise, a home has never been so sweet as this one. About 18 months ago, Elise left an abusive relationship with her children's father.
He began to drink quite heavily all the time, and that was just something, you know, that wasn't okay for the kids. You know, they didn't feel comfortable.
But in some ways, leaving was even scarier than staying.
Am I going to be able to do it? And how am I going to take care of my kids by myself? You know, and are we going to be okay?
Elise secretly put her name on a 2-month waiting list for a low-income apartment. In Douglas, where studio apartments can rent for over $1,000, she knew it was the only thing she could afford. By day, she went to nursing school and by night, worked as a janitor, making only $900 a month. Then one day, the violence at home got to be too much. While he was at work...
I went and borrowed money, and I went and got the U-Haul the next day, and I was able to move out in about 6 hours by myself.
The housing unit only charged her $50 a month at first. Now Elise is a full-time nurse. She pays $725 in rent and is saving for a down payment on a house. Lisa Thalkin is the director of the Converse Hope Center, a domestic violence and sexual assault advocacy organization. She says Elise is one of the lucky ones.
At the tail end of the last boom, we were seeing that a lot, where these people had come out with their significant other, and then the abuse happened, and they had no one to turn to, and they were 5 states away from their home.
Thalkin's agency helped 125 victims last year, but they only have emergency shelter for 2 families. After that, they pay for hotel rooms.
You drive by the hotels, and there's just all these trucks parked in front of it. You know that they're full with oil field workers. But if there's no hotel rooms, where do we put them?
Thalkin says oil and gas companies might consider supporting social services like hers that are impacted by their presence in the community. Oil and gas workers compete for whatever low-income housing is available. But she says that housing means something very different to her clients.
It's more than just shelter. It's your safe space. To be able to start over and build a safe place for yourself and your children is a huge part of their healing.
I take a tour of Douglas with the community development director, Clara Chaffin. We do see construction, but only of sprawling single-family homes worth $400,000 or $500,000. Across town, we drive by a trailer park.
I kind of keep an eye on it and find that these trailers in this particular park are running from everywhere between $750 to $1,200 a month.
Wow.
Yeah.
For an older, I mean, those
For
looked quite old.
A trailer that might be from the 50s.
Then we drive past some RV parks.
So you'll see over here, kind of down that hill, you'll see that little RV park. It's full.
Full of oil field workers. But we see very few smaller homes or apartment buildings for a struggling mom with kids and pets. Chaffin says Douglas has a hard time attracting new families because of this lack of affordable housing, even though a recent state report shows there's demand for hundreds more in Converse County.
But then you've got the developer going, well, there's nobody here who's going to take the housing, so we're not going to build it. So it's a chicken and egg kind of a deal.
Chaffin has hope that a housing study the city is currently working on will convince more developers that low-income housing will always stay filled. As the boom hits, sending housing costs out of her reach, single mom Elise has no plans to leave. Douglas is where all her family lives.
We'll be okay. We're going to have a home where we can go home and lock the door and watch TV and have peace and quiet and safety.
But her dream of a house of her own may have to wait a while. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
We hope you appreciate the excellent journalism you hear on this program every week. We cannot bring you these stories without your financial support. Please support Open Spaces, Wyoming News, and Wyoming Public Radio on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. When we come back, we'll take a look at the controversy surrounding a wolf bounty in Idaho and hear about an interesting exhibit in Bighorn. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. For years, Idaho has been at the forefront of wolf management. It was one of the first states where wolves were delisted, and it quickly opted to allow wolf hunting soon after. And now, it's taking that a step further by helping to fund a bounty program for wolf hunters and trappers. Amanda Peacher reports.
Rusty Kramer spends all winter trapping coyotes, skunks, beaver, and occasionally a wolf.
It's kind of like Christmas every day. You go check 70 traps, it could be nothing all day long. It could be five skunks, or you could have 10 coyotes, or you could have a wolf.
Last year, Kramer did get a wolf.
And I yelled over the hill to my dad, and I says, oh, got a wolf over here. And he thought I was messing with him. And it was like a salt and pepper, two-year-old female.
He shot the wolf in the trap and then took it home to skin it. Soon after, he got some money from the Foundation for Wildlife Management. Turns out the nonprofit reimburses up to $1,000 for every wolf kill. Justin Webb is founder of the nonprofit. He says that may sound like a lot of money, but it barely covers the costs for trappers like Kramer.
It's a very grueling, time-consuming process.
There's gas, he says, the cost of the traps, and of course the time. Webb says he's personally trapped 18 wolves.
For that, I've invested 208 hours and over $1,600 in fuel for every single wolf that I've caught.
Webb's organization has been paying wolf hunters and trappers for about 7 years, but now it's getting help from the state. Idaho Fish and Game gave the program a grant of $23,000.
Our preferred and primary source for management is through our hunters and trappers.
That's Derek Atterbury, chair of the Fish and Game Commission. He says hunters and trappers like Kramer and Webb help keep wolf numbers in check. Because of that, he sees no issue with state dollars going toward the program.
It fits with the management of wolves that we currently have with our sporting public and hunting and trapping.
Suzanne Stone sees it differently.
It's really troubling that the state of Idaho is doing this.
Stone is with Defenders of Wildlife, a nonprofit conservation group. She says the move is a symptom of a bigger problem. The state was supposed to manage wolves like every other predator, but it's not doing that. For example, Stone says there's no bounty program for mountain lions, and on top of that, she says hunters can trap and kill significantly more wolves.
One person, if they're a hunter and a trapper, can kill up to 20 wolves in a year, and the limit for mountain lions is 2.
Stone says this is not what the state promised.
Which was to manage wolves like bears and mountain lions. That was their specific promise to the federal government when wolves were delisted, and they are doing everything but that.
Proponents of hunting and trapping wolves say it's important to keep the predators' numbers down so that elk populations can thrive. Still,
mountain lions are actually the number one predator of elk in the state of Idaho, not wolves.
That's Jim Hayden with Idaho Fish and Game. He's a state biologist in charge of managing predators.
And if you're going to spend a dollar to improve elk, survival, it'd be more suitable to do it on mountain lions.
Either way, he says, wolf numbers are healthy in Idaho. Even with the current level of hunting and trapping, they are here to stay. Trapper Rusty Kramer agrees.
We don't want to make any animal extinct, and so we just want to manage their numbers.
It's unclear whether other states will follow Idaho's lead when it comes to wolf bounties for hunters and trappers, although Montana's legislature is already looking at a bill that would legalize the practice in that state. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Amanda Beecher.
The Brinton Museum in Bighorn, Wyoming, is home to a collection of artifacts and objects from many Plains Indian tribes. The Brinton, along with the Center for American Indian Research and Native Studies, has put together an exhibit centered around the Lakota creation story. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler sat down with Craig Howe, the director of the Center for American Indian Research, to talk about how the story has an impact today.
So, Craig, can you tell me a little bit about this exhibit?
This was the first exhibit that the Center for American Indian Research and Native Studies developed, and it's called Lakota Emergence. And it's based on a traditional narrative that was written down, we don't know when, but sometime between 1898 and 1917, because it was published in 1917. And the person who wrote it down was James Walker, and he was a physician in the Pine Ridge Reservation for that time period. That's basically the most full and complete emergence narrative that we have.
What is the Lakota emergence story about? Like, who are the central characters? What is going on?
It tells how the Lakota ancestors came to move from the underworld where they were living to this world. There's a series of Lakota narratives that make this long story. And so this is a small slice of that story. But some of the Lakota people from the underworld have been banished to this world. And so the narrative is really about two of those key persons. One is a woman who was the most beautiful of the Lakota women in the underworld. Her name was Ite, means face. When she was banished up here, the spirits gave her an ugly face. So she became two-faced woman, Anunk Ite. And then the other main character is this guy, a trickster named Ikdomi. And so those two both have reasons for getting some more Lakota people up here. She wants to have relatives. He wants to have people to play tricks on. So these two have to work together, even though she doesn't trust him, in order to trick her relatives that come up here.
And so how does that story come alive in these illustrations and works of art?
What we asked 16 Lakota artists to do was illustrate passages of that narrative. We took the narrative, it was 1,251 words, we divided it into 16 passages. And then for each passage, we asked an artist to focus on just their passage and illustrate it in some way, any way they wanted. So some of these artists made really conscious decisions to link that passage to contemporary conditions in Lakota reservations or among Lakotas today. And so this is one way where it resonates with people then. And also the variety. We have all the genres of art, or almost all of them, are represented in this exhibit.
Why do you think this story is important to tell now?
Well, so one reason is to show that Lakotas have narratives that link them to this land before there were non-Indians here. So it's not a contestation. This is our narrative. This is the Lakota narrative. And it can withstand highly critical inquiry into it. It's not something just put together as a fairy tale. It's the philosophy of the people. It's the stories that would be passed down for generations, hundreds, maybe thousands of years. And this is one of these examples that only American Indians can say they emerged here. No one else in the world can claim this is their land from the beginning of time. Only American Indians, and all American Indians, can do that. So that's part of it. And the other is to illustrate that these landscapes and landmarks in our world today are sacred sites to Lakota people or to other tribal people. So it has these other layers of intentionality and purpose to why we're developing these type of exhibits.
Do you think the story in itself reveals anything about the Lakota worldview?
Yes, it does, and it also illustrates the incorrectness of that worldview. They were not ahead of their time. They thought the world was basically flat and round. And so that's wrong. We know that's not accurate. That's not how it is. But to them, that's how it was. It also, though, shows the way of making relatives. And we see, in order for them to come up here, in order for Lakotas to be on this earth, Dokahe, the leader of those seven families that came up here, had to basically disobey what his elders told him. We are taught to obey our elders. He didn't. And because he didn't, we're here today. So I think there's this idea that there's no one way to be Lakota. It's only because someone went against a protocol that we are here.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
One other thing about the exhibit is that it illustrates the diversity of Lakotas. In their artworks, it's all these different artworks. They're all Lakota artworks. So there's no one way to paint Lakota. And the last artwork is by Dwayne Wilcox, and it's called Here We Are. And it's this representation of a Lakota family, and you have all the different types of people represented there. So it gives us all permission to be ourselves while still being Lakota.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler speaking with Craig Howe about a new exhibit based on the Lakota emergence narrative at the Brinton Museum. Thanks to those of you who helped make our Northeast Wyoming reporter a reality. We've been able to cover more of the state thanks to your financial support. Please support Wyoming News during our fund drive with your pledge at wyomingpublicmedia.org. When we come back, Wyoming's delegation is leading the latest battle over healthcare and a look at law enforcement sexual assault training. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. President Trump's now backing a lawsuit that would invalidate the entire Affordable Care Act. And that's promising to make health care a major election issue next year. And Wyoming Republicans are fine with that. Correspondent Matt Laszlo has the story from Washington.
On the campaign trail back in 2016, then businessman and reality TV star Donald Trump promised to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. But Republicans failed to in the last session of Congress when they controlled both chambers of Congress. They did wipe out the law's mandate that everyone has to have health insurance. And the administration tried to invalidate the law's requirements that insurance companies can't discriminate against people with pre-existing conditions. Now the president is backing a lawsuit that would wipe out the entire Affordable Care Act.
I think Obamacare is unconstitutional.
That's Wyoming Congresswoman Liz Cheney, who supports Trump's move to get the courts to shred the entire law, including its protections for people with pre-existing conditions. However, Cheney says she supports that provision, and she says Republicans are going to go to the mat in this health care fight.
We, as a party, are going to be on offense. The Democrats are going to continue to peddle this notion, this lie, that somehow Republicans don't want to cover people with pre-existing conditions. They're doing that because they don't want people focused on a couple of things. Number one, what a train wreck Obamacare has been.
But Democrats say Republican leaders like Cheney and Trump are trying to pull the wool over the eyes of the American people. Pennsylvania Senator Bob Casey says the fact that Republican leaders are now trying to invalidate all of Obamacare reveals how their party doesn't actually want to provide health care to all Americans.
Well, it's frankly not surprising. I mean, if you look at what, or if you examine what the Republicans have been doing the last couple of years, it's very consistent. They want to rip it away, and they've never come up with an alternative that is in any way comparable.
Casey says Democrats will be on the offensive themselves regarding health care. He says his party is going to hammer home to voters how GOP leaders want to end pre-existing condition coverage while also not offering a viable alternative.
Part of the reason for that is it's just not high on their priority list. And it's going to be a huge issue in the election. They have, in my judgment, very little prospect of protecting or preserving pre-existing conditions protections. they'll say it, but they got to prove it, and they haven't been able to do that.
Those charges irritate many Republicans, especially Wyoming's junior senator, John Barrasso.
People in Wyoming who know me as a doctor and know my wife, Bobby, is a breast cancer survivor, having been through three operations and chemotherapy twice, know that as a doctor and a husband, I'm very committed to make sure everyone with a pre-existing condition continues with their coverage.
Barrasso says it should be no secret that the GOP wants to wipe Obamacare off the books, but that doesn't mean they don't want to replace it.
What's happening now around the country is I continue to hear, and was in Wyoming this past weekend, of people that are left down by the promises of Obamacare because the rates have gone up so high, the insurance is unaffordable.
As for what's politically possible now that Democrats control the House, Barrasso says he's hopeful the two parties can keep tackling the relatively low-hanging fruit that's weighing down the current healthcare system.
There are things we can do to lower drug costs, and the president has done a number of those things. We have, in a bipartisan way, eliminated the gag rule on pharmacists, so patients can now talk to pharmacists about finding ways to get cheaper costs.
And now, basically all of the Democrats running for president are embracing so-called Medicare for All proposals that aim to eventually put most all Americans on government-administered health plans. Congresswoman Cheney says the far-left turn of the Democratic Party will come back to bite them.
In addition to all that, if you think Obamacare is bad, just wait for the next shoe to drop, which for the Democrats is Medicare for All. You know, they want the government in charge of everybody's health care, and they don't want to talk about it. They can't even get a budget put together because it's so expensive. The combination of their, you know, government takeover of health care and the Green New Deal means they can't get a budget put on the floor.
President Trump now says the GOP will wait until after the 2020 election to try to overhaul the health care system again, a strategy Cheney supports.
The president has made very clear that Republicans are going to be focused on making sure that people have choices, have access, have affordable care, but that we're in a situation where they get to make those decisions, not this one-size-fits-all federal government. And we're going to continue working on that both here in the House and in the Senate.
While the extreme wings of the two parties want to either invalidate Obamacare or put everyone on government-run health insurance, there is a bipartisan group of lawmakers looking for a path to try and stabilize the current system. But with 2020 politics already heating up, it's unlikely party leaders can bridge the ideological divide in the near future. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Author and journalist Ron Francell is out with a new book. It tells the story of a Wyoming couple who committed several murders in the 1970s and 80s to get their own happily ever after, and how they were finally brought to justice after several decades. Wyoming Public Radio's Caroline Ballard spoke with Francell about his book, Alice and Gerald, A Homicidal Love Story. He says he became interested in the story after hearing about their arrests in the news a few years ago.
Even then, it looked like a story with Shakespearean echoes, and I wanted to write about it. Alice and Gerald is about real-life Wyoming and about a real-life couple who separately and together murdered at least four people, probably five, as the book reveals. And then they lived happily ever after. At its heart is the story of how this series of dogged detectives pursued this case over 3 to 4 decades, never able really to connect the right dots. One of the great stumbling blocks for these detectives was Wyoming's often inaccessible open spaces. One of those frustrating dots that could never be connected is, where are the victims? And in Wyoming, they could have been anywhere.
Alice and Gerald ended up murdering several people, including two small children who were Gerald's sons. And you ended up interviewing Gerald Uden several times. What was it like to talk to someone so in-depth, someone who had committed these crimes?
It was fascinating to me because I've talked to a lot of killers. I've been up close with all kinds of sociopaths and psychopaths. There's no question that Gerald Uden is that. But in our conversations and in 2 or 3 years of correspondence that we've kept up, he comes off like your weird but favored uncle. He's pleasant. He's got a sense of humor. Occasionally he would recite poetry or song lyrics. But then I would ask about the killings, and he would lapse into this very cold, distant, distracted, disengaged kind of attitude, and then describe them in the most grotesque ways, but very calmly, as if he were describing his lunch today.
What other resources went into creating the detail in this book? Because it reads like a novel, the conversations that people have, the descriptions. Where did you go for those?
Well, first, I was a journalist for my career, and in a sense, an old school journalist who believes in getting your boots on the ground and telling the story from the perspective of the place. I talked to 150 people. I had unprecedented access to the 30, 40 years of investigative reports here. But probably moreover, I lived this place. I am Wyoming. It's my heart earth. I lived there in Wyoming at the same time these secret crimes were happening. I was just a kid. And I knew these places that I described, whether it's a trailer park or the desolate deserts of western and central Wyoming. For most of America, Wyoming is literally and figuratively a foreign country. It might as well be a crater on the surface of the moon. I wanted to bring that to the wider audience, and to describe my place in all of its occasionally violent colors.
There are many cold cases in Wyoming, and you mention a few in the book, that are never solved, that there is no closure on. What do you think it means to detectives and to Wyoming residents to see closure, at least in one case?
Closure is always good, and people always feel good about it. And really, in the last 20 years, we've seen the rise of the cold case detective. It really wasn't a big thing before that, but then TV and a few other things happened, and people started to be interested, and agencies started to establish cold case detectives and files and going after them. Now, today, they're still doing it in their free time kind of thing. At some point, people just stopped looking. The landscape is just too insurmountable. And they have other crimes that are more immediate and more easily solvable for families who can get justice right now. In Wyoming, there are several, maybe more than we want to admit. Chief among them is the Amy Robechtel disappearance over in Lander. Lisa Marie Kimmel, the Little Miss disappearance and murder. In that, she's locked in a shed so far out that nobody could hear her scream. Her whole car was buried in a hole that her killer dug in the middle of the prairie with a backhoe, and people saw that, but nobody thought it was odd. Wyoming's coldest case is from the 1930s. A newlywed bride named Olga Mauger and her husband hiked up into the mountains at Togedy Pass. At some point, she got tired and she sat on a log to rest while he went ahead to spot some elk. When he came back, Olga was gone. Searchers came and they covered the area, but they never found her. Had she been dragged off and eaten by a grizzly? Had she gotten cold feet about their new marriage and run off? Had her husband murdered her? Nobody knows. Not to this day. And there's been no trace of her ever found. So I think there you have it. Not all cases are so intimately entangled with the open spaces of Wyoming, but there are plenty. I don't think there's anyone among us who hasn't driven across Wyoming and occasionally mused that if there was anything they needed to hide, including a body, that this is the place they could do it.
Ron Francell is an author. His new book, Alice and Gerald, A Homicidal Love Story, is out April 9th. Ron, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Carolyn.
April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month. While the issue has gotten more and more attention, sexual assault is a crime that's still chronically underreported across the nation. Concern about how the criminal justice system will respond is one of the top reasons victims say they don't report. In response, some law enforcement agencies in Wyoming see training as a way to gain victims' trust. But as Wyoming Public Radio's Tennessee Watson reports, that's not a statewide priority.
Tara Muir says Wyoming is a crapshoot for victims of sexual assault.
Definitely from what we hear from survivors, it's very hit or miss out there across the state.
Muir is the policy director at the Wyoming Coalition Against Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
Even within a county, our advocates might talk about, wow, we sure hope Officer A is the one who comes out on this call and not Officer B, which is heartbreaking.
Muir says some survivors would rather forego the criminal justice system than risk an interaction with an officer who makes them feel like the assault was their fault. Laramie's police chief, Dale Stalder, agrees.
We have to do a better job making sure that victim felt a sense of justice throughout and felt supported. So then that victim goes and tells other people that have been victimized by that crime, hey, it's okay to report.
Not every report will end in prosecution, but Stalder wants victims to feel like they've been heard and that their case has been thoroughly investigated. That starts with an understanding that trauma can alter a victim's ability to recount what happened.
If you report to me that stuff was stolen out of your car, you don't have all those emotions. You've been traumatized to a certain degree, but you don't have all the emotions that you have if you got raped. And in that trauma, your brain does all kinds of different stuff, and it confuses and complicates your ability to then tell the story.
Stalder says training on the impacts of trauma helps officers better understand what the victim is experiencing. But he wants to be clear that successful prosecution isn't contingent on these techniques.
Trauma-informed capability may give you some better tools, but investigating a rape is no different than investigating a homicide or a burglary or anything else from a putting together the evidence perspective. It's just providing extra tools to do a better job in that victim-centered way. I think it's valuable.
It's valuable enough that Stalder decided to train his entire department, including patrol officers. The thinking is it's less of a crapshoot for victims if every officer is trained. But he says that's not happening across the entire state.
Wyoming is very much controlled at the local level.
Once peace officers graduate from the Law Enforcement Academy, they're required to do 40 hours of additional training every 2 years. But the focus of that training is left up to local agencies. The Peace Officers Standards and Training Commission, or POST, logs officers' training hours. Gangs 1, defensive driving, active shooter, firearms qualification, drug interdiction, radar, survival seminar. I sorted through the last 10 years of that data. Out of over 180,000 course entries, I found that around 1% of that training focused on sexual assault. And the amount of training varies all across the state. Step out of the city of Laramie into Albany County, and about half of the sheriff's office is trained. I asked Albany County Sheriff Dave O'Malley why, when we know sexual assault is so pervasive and so damaging, does he not require all of his officers to have additional training?
You know, that's really a good question, because it's something that we strive to always move forward.
He says increasing the amount of training is a goal, but Albany County has limited resources.
Our training budget is $22,000 a year, and that's for 46 people. And we've been pretty lucky at being able to maintain that budget, even though it's about $8,000 less than it was 10 years ago.
Sending officers out of state for training can cost thousands of dollars. There's flights, hotels, course fees, and then there's the overtime pay for whoever covers the shifts while officers are gone. Larger agencies like the Laramie PD might have an easier time moving folks around to fill shifts, but that's harder for the state's smaller agencies, such as the Sheriff's Department, with fewer people on staff.
If we can get it localized, if we can bring it here, we get more bang for our buck and we can get more people involved.
Police Chief Dale Stalder says legislation that passed during the 2018 session has started to divert funds from speeding fines to be used for more training. He's hopeful that some of that money could be used to bring sexual violence training to more remote parts of the state. But just because the money is there doesn't mean that there'll be interest.
You have to sell it to your people, because I got guys that have been investigating crimes for a long time, and now I'm telling them, no, investigate it like this. And they can be resistant.
Stalder says pressure from the community helps, like when women in Casper came forward several years ago because they felt reports of sexual violence were being brushed off.
And the police department up there reacted to that perception by really putting in some strong training and policy protocols for investigation of sexual assault.
The Post data shows that in 2018, over 50 officers with the Casper Police Department were trained on the trauma-informed approach. Stalder says similar change can happen across Wyoming if everyone speaks up in their community. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Tennessee Watson.
If you're someone who shares our stories, you need to support us. Wyoming Public Radio is a valuable news source. Let us keep bringing you the important journalism that you get to hear each and every day by pledging at wyomingpublicmedia.org. We will wrap up the program in just a moment. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. When you think of archaeology, mummies might come to mind, or people digging up the remains of an ancient village. But for at least one man, archaeology is all about a very specific piece of history, beer. Ray Ellen Bichelle reports.
Travis Rupp didn't intend to go into beer archaeology. It just sort of happened. A few years ago, he wrapped up grad school in Roman history and archaeology and started teaching part-time at the University of Colorado Boulder.
Of course, that's not going to cut it, paying the bills, so I was looking for other work.
Eventually, he got a second job as a bartender at Avery Brewing Company. That's when things started to get interesting.
The taproom employees at that time, we were trying to educate ourselves on beer history, beer styles, that kind of stuff.
And Rupp noticed something.
There really aren't that many beer historians, one. Two, there are also just massive gaps in the history. There's just not a lot of material that's been produced on certain periods throughout time.
One of those gaps was his area of focus, the ancient Mediterranean. So he started looking into it.
And it just kind of blew up from there.
Rupp is now in charge of research and development at Avery. And over the last few years, he's pored through literature and traveled the world in search of clues to how ancient civilizations made and consumed beer. He's concluded there are some things we have all wrong about beer history. First off,
you know, there's this perception that's been written about that ancient or historic beers were just undrinkable and crap and thick and just bleh.
But Rupp says the ancients wouldn't settle for mundane gruel any more than we would.
Well, we know the Egyptians didn't do that. They actually record putting fruits and things into their beer to sweeten it and to literally varietize the beer.
And the Romans made lists of beer prices based on quality. Egyptian beer was low on that list.
They really stomp all over Egyptian beer. It was the cheap stuff that if you couldn't afford anything else, that's what you drank.
Then there's another assumption, that if a culture's records and art don't frequently and obviously reference beer, then they probably didn't make it or drink it. To that argument, Rupp counters with this.
How many books have you read on milk? You know, do you know the history of the paperclip? No.
In some seemingly beerless societies, he says, it's possible the drink was so common it just didn't seem worth writing about. Or at least it didn't seem worth writing about to the highfalutin sliver of the population that could actually write.
It's just a mundane, everyday thing.
But a mundane thing Rupp is fascinated with. And not just the history, he actually tries to recreate what ancient brews would have tasted like, too. He's made 8 so-called ales of antiquity, some of them in the kegs sitting in front of us in the brewery.
And the one thing that we've been really quite surprised by is not a single one of them is undrinkable.
Customers might notice them on the menu in the taproom for a limited time until they run out. But Rupp keeps a personal stash of them in a back room, which I get to check out. Like this one, based primarily on ancient Israel.
This is gonna be Beersheba.
It has a peach color and tastes like a funky fruit roll-up. Its smell suggests baby spit-up. There's a reason for that.
There is a compound in beer called ethyl butyrate, and literally it's described as baby puke.
I also get to try his version of a 1,200-year-old European recipe. It's so loaded with spices, it tastes like drinking an herb garden. For that one, Rupp spent a few weeks brewing with monks in Italy.
What's it like to have monks as drinking buddies?
It was awesome. I will tell you, we had lunch with them one day, and wow, could those boys put beer back. I'm like, wow, how do these guys hold it together? And they still don't swear.
The monastery beer wasn't too popular with today's customers, but Rupp's corn-based Peruvian chicha was a hit.
We ran out of it. We don't have any left.
It called for an odd ingredient, corn, chewed and partially fermented in human spit. So Rupp got colleagues like this guy, Colin Quinn, to gather around a bucket and get chomping.
I know some people that I've talked to, they are a bit wary of trying a beer with spit in it, but we boiled the beer, so you're going to boil off any bad things.
Rupp's latest project is the first one available in cans. It's a porter fermented in oak barrels, and it's based on what he says George Washington would have been cracking open at Mount Vernon in his retirement years.
I will never be so audacious as to say this is exactly what he was drinking, but I think it's a pretty damn good representation.
All of this begs a question. 1,000 years from now, what will archaeologists think of our beer? Will they look back and try to recreate an Avery IPA or a Fat Tire Ale?
You know, the craft beer industry is such a small blip on the historical radar.
No, he says. They'll probably land on what was most consistently and massively produced, the light lagers. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Raelynn Bischel.
A somewhat unusual instrument claimed first place in the annual Dorothy Jacoby Student Soloist Competition at the University of Wyoming in March. As she told Wyoming Public Radio's Micah Schweitzer, Michaela Peterson is the second saxophone player in her family to perform with the UW Symphony Orchestra in the concerto competition.
It was my brother. He performed in the 2015 concerto competition. Yep.
That has to be some sort of record, not only to have multiple family members, but on saxophone.
Yeah, he was actually the reason that I started playing saxophone, so it was just kind of cool to see him. I didn't think I would be up there at all, so.
The saxophone has a relatively recent history in classical music.
Yes, it's very new. There's not a lot of pieces written for it. Our repertoire is very small that we have to pick from, especially concertos, so it was pretty exciting that I got to be up there.
Yeah, because, you know, you see the winners of this competition year after year. It's every spring semester, and it's not unusual for pianists to win, or violinists, or flutists. There was a flutist who came in second this year, but it certainly was noticeable when we saw that a saxophone player had won.
Yeah, a saxophone player hasn't won for, like, 10 years, so it was kind of nice to break the streak.
And what did you play?
I played the Henry Tomasi Concerto.
And tell me a bit about that.
Well, Henry Tomasi was a French composer and conductor. He wrote the piece in 1949, and then it was later premiered by Marcel Mule in 1950. It was actually kind of cool. I got to play the piece about 69 years later than the first time it was premiered.
Why did you pick this piece?
So I picked this piece because it was actually like a piece that was on another competition that I tried out for. I actually didn't know anything about the piece before, and I actually didn't make that competition, but I found that the music that they had for the requirements was incredible. And this was one of the pieces, so I just kept playing it and I really found a love for it.
Do you feel like there's a sort of a steeper hill to climb as an instrument with a smaller repertoire and a shorter history in classical music than the more established instruments?
Yeah, I definitely, like, going into the competition, I kind of felt like the underdog just because I didn't know exactly, like, how my piece was going to sound with orchestra. I'd never played with orchestra before, and like you said, like, pianists and stringed instruments always win this competition.
So what do you think set you apart?
I honestly don't know. Everybody played really well. I guess maybe just I felt really confident walking out there. And I felt good about how I played, so.
And just to put this in context, there were something like 40 competitors in the first round and 6 finalists, one of which was you, mm-hmm. And then ultimately you were the winner.
The first round was, I think, more nerve-wracking than the second round because I really, like, my mind was set in just being able to play with the orchestra, not necessarily, like, winning the competition or anything like that. The first round, you compete with your pianist. And then if you win that round, then you get to go on to the next round.
So music, of course, is an art form, but in this case, it's also a competitive art form. How do you reconcile competition with music?
That's kind of a hard question. I obviously wanted to win the competition, but instead of thinking about who I was competing against, I was trying to think about just playing musically throughout and giving the audience a good performance. Sometimes I think that people get too involved in competition in music. Yes, music is extremely competitive. I'm learning that as I want to go to grad school and realize that everybody wants to go to the same grad school that I want to. But I also think that, like, if you're playing musically and you're thinking about only playing musically and not about everybody else that you're trying to compete against, I think that your performance will be better in the long run.
So you're a music education major. You're a senior at UW. You just mentioned you'd like to go to grad school. What's next?
Well, so right now I'm practicing for my senior recital. That's like the culmination of all of your years at UW. And then after that, I'm going to go student teach in Casper, Wyoming in the fall. And then in the spring, my plan is to go and audition at grad schools and hopefully get in somewhere with a good scholarship.
Michaela Peterson is the 2019 winner of the Dorothy Jacoby Concerto Competition at the University of Wyoming. Michaela, thanks so much and good luck in your future.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces, a winner of 8 national awards for Best News and Public Affairs Program. If you missed part of the show or want to hear individual segments, you can find them at our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org. Just click on Open Spaces.
Never miss a program by signing up for our podcast. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts. Big thanks to our web editor, Anna Rader, for putting all of this together. Remember to help us cover Wyoming and the region with your pledge at wyomingpublicmedia.org. You help pay for the travel, the equipment, and most of our reporters. Please make your pledge at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.